This is Dominic Preziosi, and you're listening to the Commonweal Podcast. Well, summer's here, and today we're featuring interviews with a trio of women writers about their new books. Our managing editor, Kate Luckey, speaks with Molly McCulley-Brown, a poet with a new collection of personal essays, and memoirist Marie Mutsuki-Mockett with a new book about her travels around the country with wheat harvesters, and novelist Amy Jo Burns. Kate's interviews are coming right up here on the Commonweal Podcast. So I'm here with Kate Luckey. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Dominic.
And this is kind of a special time for us here on the Commonweal Podcast. Kate is our managing editor. She's been with us for about 2+ years, and she's on to, I guess, bigger and better things. Is that right, Kate?
Well, I don't know if anything could be better than Commonweal, but let's just say different.
That's the right
answer.
Let's just
say different things. Yeah, so my husband is going to Stanford Law School in the fall. And so we are moving to California, which in a way is a sort of homecoming for me because, as listeners to the podcast may remember, I'm originally from the West. I'm from Oregon. So it's a move closer to family, but also sadly a move away from Commonweal, which, as you mentioned, has been my home now for 2+ years as managing editor and then a year before that as an intern.
Well, I know that we're of mixed feelings about your departure, Kate. Obviously, we're hopeful for your future, but you know, you really were a big contributor here. And I think I can speak for the whole staff in saying that you will certainly be missed. But let me ask you a little bit too about some of what you recall from here. Maybe mention some highlights, if you will.
Sure. So when I think back at my time at Commonweal, I think about it as a place where I really deepened and broadened my interests, as well as a place where I became very known for what I was sort of interested in before I came to the magazine. It's a place where I learned a lot about theology and politics and philosophy, and a place where I got to read a lot of kinds of writing that I wouldn't have been exposed to before. Obviously, on a day-to-day level, it's a place where I learned how to do things like make schedules for a magazine and copy edit. And at the same time, this has been a place where I felt really known intellectually. So of the books we're discussing today, the first book that we're going to discuss, two people actually brought it over to my desk, two different editors on the staff, to say, hey, check this out. You would like this. And that's happened to me throughout my time at Commonweal and is a really good reflection of the sort of intellectual community, people that will see a collection of short stories or a book about the attention economy, and they'll say, hey, Kate would really like this. And so it's a place where at our famous lunch table conversations and at our Christmas parties, in our happy hours, all things that happened when we were all in the office together that I hope will happen for all of you again soon. It's a really curious place, but it also a place that I felt really known. So I'll miss that.
Well, it's been great having you here. And I also, before we move over to the interviews, I just want to call our listeners' attention to all the pieces that Kate has written for the magazine and the website. And you can find them all on our website. Just type in her name and please, you know, enjoy the number of pieces she's written for us over these past couple of years. So, Kate, why don't we turn over to hear about Molly McCulley-Brown's book?
So Molly McCulley-Brown's book is a collection of essays called Places I've Taken My Body. Brown is a poet. She has cerebral palsy. And the book is a set of brief essays that sort of respond to her cerebral palsy. They explore limitation and capacity, but they're about lots of other things as well. They're about place. They're about surgery as a concept. She's a convert to Catholicism. So I reviewed the book in the June issue of Commonweal and spoke to Molly for the podcast as well.
Great. Let's take a listen.
So we're here to talk about your new essay collection, Places I've Taken My Body. And as I read it, I really was struck by the sense in which it feels like a biography in fragments. It's very meditative. It's very recursive. But we do sort of get bits and pieces of your life story. So maybe you could start by telling us what that life story is and some of the images and places you return to in the book in order to explain and understand it.
Yeah. In the beginning, it was really funny when I started working on this essay collection, I was really resistant to the idea that it was going to be a memoir. And not because I don't love and admire memoirs, I'm an avid reader of them, but because I think I had the the sort of sensation, it was like, okay, you're not even 30 years old and nothing particularly extraordinary has happened to you. And really, does anyone need a memoir from you at this moment in time? But I really found as I was working on it that I did keep coming back to these sort of central threads and stories in my own life, less out of a kind of preoccupation with any notion that my existence was particularly interesting and important, but more out of a sense that revisiting these moments in my own life allowed me to kind of work out some broader relationships to various things in the world. I mean, the really basic story is that I was born at 27 weeks and I was an identical twin. And we were obviously both incredibly small and very premature. And she died about 36 hours after we were born. And I spent a very long time in the hospital. And as a result of that premature birth and the attendant oxygen deprivation and trauma that came from that birth, I ended up with a neurological disorder called cerebral palsy that affects my balance and my muscle tone and my coordination and has meant that I have mostly now use a wheelchair to get around. And that neurological disorder meant that throughout my childhood and adolescence and even now into my adult life, I was subject to a lot of therapeutic and surgical and orthopedic intervention and spent a lot of time in and out of the hospital. But it's really the thing in some ways that has turned me into the kind of reader that I am and the kind of writer that I am. And so the book traces not only the kind of story of my physical development and my changing relationship with my body and with my diagnosis as I age. It also traces my relationship to literature and to faith and to place and to a sense of selfhood and a relationship with this twin sister who I, in some sense, really feel like I knew and really miss, and who also, of course, you know, never got the chance to have her own independent life, and it charts the kind of complicated territory of what does it mean to miss and to carry around a person that you never really knew, and to look in the mirror and to know exactly what she would be like, and the book doesn't move in a linear fashion, largely because my relationships to all of these things, I feel like, didn't move in a linear fashion. I think the sense that we sort of live our lives in this direct line and where one thing just develops from and leads to the next, it's always felt to me like a little bit of a fiction. I feel like my life is so recursive. It keeps coming back to these same things, and every time I attend to them, or every time I think about them, or every time they reoccur in my life, I have a different relationship to them. And so my hope is that the book models some of that feeling.
It really does. I was so happy to hear you use the word recursive, because you really do get the sense that you are examining and re-examining not only these different books that have really moved you and these different biographical events, but your own interpretations of those things and how they've changed over time and what it means that you've related to your body in this or that way, or to your sister in this or that way at different moments of your life. So even though the book is very meditative and lyric and recursive, it also feels like you're forming arguments about disability and creativity and autonomy. So what are some of those arguments? What are some of the themes or thesis statements you found emerging as you wrote? And did any of them surprise you?
So it's really funny to hear a reader sort of describe that feeling. I'm glad that the book feels in some way like it's making arguments. Although for me, I would say I feel less like I was sort of intentionally chasing after like particularly predefined thesis statements or trying to prove particular ways of thinking about the world, and more that you see in that book, I think you see me trying to work out for myself and articulate for myself my evolving positionality in relationship to in my body, to grief, to literature, to faith, to so many of those things. I mean, the book, I think, is really interested in interrogating the kind of complicated result of the medical model of disability. And that is the model that says, you know, you're born with a disability and it means something is wrong or errant or incorrect in your body and your brain. And it's the responsibility of the medical community to do whatever they can to alter and to fix that defect to whatever degree they're capable of doing so. And it suggests essentially that whatever is causing the disability is something intrinsically wrong with you, with your body, your brain, your neurology, who you are. And that essentially your whole life will be about trying to get as close to correcting that as possible, even if it's not ever going to totally come to pass. And I should say there are a lot of there are a lot of things that I owe the medical model, right? I've had some amazing doctors. I have unquestionably had some surgical intervention that is responsible in many ways for the fact that I'm as mobile as I am. And so the book is definitely not interested in sort of saying, you know, there's nothing helpful in modern medicine. It's in fact quite interested in the development of surgery and of medical history. But I think it's also interested in interrogating what it does to your self-image and what it does to your sense of selfhood if you are a person who comes into the world and understands themselves as something wrong or something broken from their earliest moments and understands that they, you know, you owe people a debt of gratitude for trying to fix you, and also they're never going to be able to do it, right? And it's interested in sort of problematizing that way of thinking about disability and thinking about the body, and less in kind of making any argument that says this is so damaging and you know we need to do this differently, and more in kind of tracing the ways in which, in some ways that I don't think I was even totally aware of until I was working on the book, so many of my choices and self-conceptions are a result of that understanding, you know. And so the book arrives, you know, the book is called Places I've Taken My Body, and it's a kind of travel log in some senses of all the places that I've lived and all the places that I've been and the way in which my body and my brain and my selfhood have existed and changed inside each one of them. But it arrives, you know, the very last line of the book, and it's a kind of ironic last line for this moment in time, is that the very last line of the book is, I stay where I am. And it arrives at this kind of place of necessary stillness, in which I have sort of arrived at this place where I think I come to understand that I can't just keep moving and running and believing that if I'm successful and full of motion and never slow down, I'm eventually going to outrun the truths that are painful about my body or my life. And instead it ends in this place of not total and not permanent, but at least sort of temporary intentional stasis. And it's interested, I think, in the value of that, which is of course particularly funny now. And I hope resonant now, when the whole world has sort of been cast into this place of inevitable and essential stasis, where the thing that we need to do in order to be okay, ironically, is to stay where we are.
So one of the kinds of places that you find yourself in the book are churches. The cathedral is sort of a symbol of something that you can access at one point in your life. All of those stairs, the cumbersome altars, churches are sort of notorious for being really inaccessible. You find yourself coming to church again in young adulthood and converting to Catholicism. So I'm wondering if you could speak to our listeners a little bit about that process of conversion and maybe how it ties into attention and some of the other themes that we've been talking about.
Yeah. So my father grew up Catholic, but is not practicing. And my mother, I like to say, just grew up with a lot of manners. And that's about as close as she gets to religion. We didn't go regularly to church, but I grew up in rural Virginia, in a part of the South that is really drenched in evangelical Southern Baptist culture. And so most of the kids I went to school with, that was the tradition that they were raised in. That was the kind of pervasive culture in my hometown as I was growing up then. And that, I think, gave me a really interesting and sort of complicated relationship with religion, because on the one hand, it came to symbolize, you know, it symbolized in my household a lot of what can sometimes feel like the worst religion has to offer, you know, to bigotry and prejudice and inflexibility and a kind of rabidly anti-intellectual attitude. And on the other hand, it was clearly of so much comfort and sustenance to so many of the people around us, right? And so that was a strange space of conflict that I think for a long time my relationship to religion inhabited. But I was always really interested in theology and really moved by religious devotion. And I think as a result of the fact that my twin sister Frances died so young, and my sense that she's never felt entirely gone to me, and I've always felt sure in this way that I have no kind of logical language for that, some part of her persists somewhere. That sort of gave me no choice but to believe in something, because what's the other explanation? And I think finding my way to Catholicism, you know, it's a faith I found my way through to largely through reading, but it's also a faith, I think, you know, that I was drawn to potentially paradoxically, because it is such an embodied tradition and such an embodied theology, and because it's not a faith that suggests, you know, our bodies are these like entrapped places that we're in, that are these like limiting cages, and to be saved or to move on from this life means to be free of them. In fact, it suggests the opposite, right? That our bodies, our physical existence, our corporeal inhabiting of the world is central to who we are, right? And that actually in paradise, we'll be resurrected back into the bodies that we inhabit. And so it gave me this framework to be able to, and also to have to do the hard work of conceiving of my body, not as a punishment or an accident or a mistake or a thing to escape from, but as something that was deeply not only sort of central to, but constitutive of who I was. And that's been a really profound thing for me. And it's a really profound thing that is, as you point out, often in tension with the difficulty that I have accessing, you know, physical sacred spaces or the ways in which the kind of performance of the mass involves physical gestures that are challenging for me. And those things aren't tensions and conflicts that I feel like I have an easy resolution to any more than, you know, some of my quarrels with the way that the sort of Catholic Church functions in the world are things that I have an easy resolution to. But I think, you know, we kind of have two choices, right? And one is, you know, if we belong to religious institutions and there are things we find hard to reconcile inside of them, we can say, you know, okay, this isn't mine and it doesn't belong to me and I don't belong here or I don't want to belong here. And we can kind of abandon them to the people who inhabit the most extreme versions of them, right? And aren't comfortable with tension or conflict. Or we can say like, you know, no, this is mine. And it's a tradition that I believe in. It is a place I am at home because I insist on being at home here. And it's a place it's a thing I want to make better, an institution I want to make better and more reflective of the divinity and the holiness that's important to me. And I think in my best moments, you know, that's what I hope that, you know, you be part of the body of the church and the body of the church looks more like your body. And that's a good thing.
Absolutely. Well, Molly, I've really enjoyed our conversation and I really enjoyed places I've taken my body. Be well and thanks again.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. Thanks for this conversation and for your attention to the book.
So, Kate, why don't we talk about our next guest?
So the next author that I spoke with is Marie Mutsuki Maket, and her new book is called American Harvest, and it's a work of narrative reported nonfiction. In it, Marie travels around the country with a group of wheat harvesters, and the book covers the science of farming and talks about the people who grow and harvest our food, but it also talks about race, the urban and rural divide, evangelicalism, and other expressions of religion that she encounters. It might be helpful to know that throughout the interview, Marie will mention a character named Eric. He's the lead harvester on the crew she travels with around the country.
Great. Let's listen.
Marie, thank you so much for being with us today on the Common Wheel podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This is my great pleasure to be here.
So today we're talking about your new book, American Harvest, God, Country, and Farming in the Heartland. And I wanted to start by reading a sentence from the prologue to the book. This is the story of the land and the people who own it and how they learn over and over again who owns what and how best to coax things out of the land and how planting and harvesting teach them what it is to believe or how they try to take what they believe and plant it in the land. Such a beautiful sentence, and it also serves as an effective summary of this book, which really takes on the structure of a journey. So the book tells the story of your travels with a group of wheat harvesters through Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Nebraska, Idaho, and Kansas. And you work together in the fields, you have conversations, you share meals, you relax together, you go to church together. And so my first question is, how did you come to this project? How did you get access to this group of harvesters?
It really was an extraordinary opportunity. People don't generally get access to this world, which is very particular, very private, very modest, and very kind of unto itself. So we've had a farm in Nebraska and a little bit in Colorado for the past 100 years. The grounds have belonged to my family, and we've planted wheat and harvested it. And in the summers, I would go to Japan with my mother, and then I would go to the wheat harvest with the entire family. So I grew up kind of aware of harvest and of farming. My father was always on the phone with farmers. And then about 15 years ago, when my father was still alive, and I was sitting in what we call the Quonset, which is a half cylindrical stainless steel storage unit that you find on the Great Plains. And inside there's a bunkhouse that had been built. It's a temporary living unit for people who come in to harvest the crops. And I was sitting there thinking, why is it that we seem to be using GMOs and we believe in evolution, and yet the farmers who I meet are undoubtedly very devout Christian, some of whom believed in creationism but had no problem using GMOs. And yet when I would talk to my friends in New York City and tell them that I was on a farm, one of the first questions I would get was, is your farm organic? Mm-hmm. And I knew that most of my friends in New York were atheists. They were not Christian. And that if they saw where I was, they would find this environment very exotic and strange. And I thought, well, there's sort of a disconnect here as to why my friends want organic food and are atheists and would not be comfortable with GMOs. And yet the people who I'm talking to on the farm are Christians and would embrace what we call the science of farming.
You really do work throughout this book. And I'm wondering if you could tell us what daily life looked like for these traveling harvest crews, what your life looked like. And you mentioned things like heavy machinery and parking. Those are some of my favorite parts of the book, those details about the lived experience of the farmers.
We would usually get up, you know, maybe around 6:30 or so, and everybody would convene in Eric and Emily's trailer. Emily is Eric's wife. And we would say grace, and then we would have a quick breakfast, which was often very silent. And then Eric would give instructions as to what we were going to do that day, you know, where we were going to go and what we were going to cut. And then everybody would finish breakfast and load up with the water and whatever tools they needed and head out into the field. And if it was a field that we knew was essentially ready to be cut, we could just pick up where we left off. But the drama was always around whether or not a field was ripe. And that depended on whether the moisture was at a certain point and whether the protein in the wheat was rich enough that the grain that came out of the field could go into the usually a cooperative elevator in town. So with these farming towns, the railroad usually runs through the town, and there's a large structure, like a bunch of cylindrical silos that people may have seen, called the cooperative elevator. And harvesters from around the country get hired to cut the wheat and bring in these loads of wheat to the elevator, where, assuming that it, you know, meets a certain criteria, that wheat gets pooled into the cooperative elevator. And then somewhere else, somebody places an order for the grain, and the railroad will come through and pick up that pooled grain when those orders come through. But there's a lot of urgency around getting the wheat out of the field because the weather in the Great Plains is very changeable. And the book, you know, showcases thunderstorms and lightning storms and a tornado, and something like that can go through a field and completely destroy it. So the minute a field is ripe, there was all of this attention to get the grain out. And it could be quite dramatic. So many different things could go wrong. And then that's where the ability of the crew to work as a team and really rely on each other becomes so important. You know, there are times when equipment gets stuck in the mud or something breaks, and then the crew has to come together to solve the problem. It was really very moving to watch this in action. And in places where the dew didn't set in too early in the evening, we would cut really late at night. Sometimes in the book, people are cutting until 11 o'clock at night. But every Sunday, no matter what, Eric would stop and we would go to church. And the equipment is enormous. It's many tons, and everything is extremely wide. And a lot of these fields are really wild. And so the guys were trying to navigate this equipment under electrical wires or over little tiny bridges or over cattle guards. And so every single day was different. Every single day had different challenges, and every part of the country had different challenges that people had to contend with. I, in general, feel a lot of gratitude to how hard people work. Most of the people I saw wanted very badly to do a good job. They don't make a lot of money. They farm because they really love the land and they love the process of raising crops and harvesting crops. And, you know, I didn't see anybody liberally spraying anything with Roundup. And most people work really hard and do a really sincere job. And we should feel pretty good, I think, in general about our food supply. That was my feeling.
There's this great moment where in the trailer over one of your mealtime conversations, I think Eric or one of the harvesters says, oh, if the cell towers all went down, what could those people in the cities do? And someone says very big-heartedly and generously, well, we would feed them all. And it's just such a poignant moment because, again, so much of the book is spent talking about the felt distance from the city politically, religiously, in terms of values. But then there's this sense that all the work that's being done is to feed the people in New York so we can go to the store and buy our loaf of bread and not have to think twice about it. It's really moving the way that they think about their work and vocation.
It's very interesting because some of them have that consciousness, and then, of course, some of them don't. If you're going to be a farmer, you will be busy with the ground from April, potentially through October. You know, you don't have time to be doing something else. It's a full commitment. So it makes it hard to get to know another way of life other than the one that you're doing. And those of us who are working in the city, you know, your job, there's no such thing as a 9-to-5 job, right? We're really working many more hours than that. We need it made easy for us to have access to food and produce, so we don't really necessarily know how food is grown or where it comes from. Something that I had always sensed but never fully understood is the way in which this country was settled is mirrored in where we have these classically agriculturally rich areas and where our cities are. One of the things I've tried to do in the book is show how the settlement of the land is part of what causes the fracture and the polarization, and that that process of settlement is ongoing, whether we know it or not, and that that's a piece of what contributes to the ways in which we feel this huge divide.
That gets to some of the writing you do about Indigenous peoples in the book, and you spend time at powwows, for instance, but also going to Native American cemeteries and to museums and learning about the original inhabitants of the land that you're farming. How does race factor into the story you tell about your time with the crew?
You know, race ended up becoming an important piece of the story. And here I have to say, I somewhat naively thought that it was not going to be important. By that, I mean, I thought, I'm going to go on this crew and I'm going to write about what I see, and I'll just be this kind of invisible narrator reporting the facts of what I see. There is a history of this kind of objective journalism where a writer goes in, looks at the landscape, describes what people are doing, and then presents that as a kind of objective truth. And they're wonderful writers who have kind of written in this way. And they're generally male and they're generally white. And I thought, I'm going to go do that too. And it became clear by the time I get to Oklahoma, it was incredibly clear that that wasn't possible, that I couldn't just see a Native American crew planting sweet potatoes and not be noticed. You know, that's the first moment where somebody says, are you an Indian to me? Where an Indian says, are you an Indian to me? And I thought, oh, I'm not going to be able to pass through this landscape sort of as an invisible person. I keep getting mistaken for being a Native American by the Native Americans. And it really forced me to address what the history was of the land where I was. When I'm in New York City, everybody is from everywhere, which is one of the reasons why I love New York City so much. And so I don't constantly have to explain what my personal history is. And so I had to think a lot more about race as a result of that than I had anticipated. And, you know, that then calls into question how the country was settled and who was first given farmland and who was first going across the Oregon Trail and who was first setting up farms and how the country expanded from the East Coast, from the original colonies, and how people moved around through the country to the point that we have the arrangement that we have today.
And then how about religion? You're going to church all around the country with this crew, many different kinds of churches, denominations. How did you experience those services? And what did they show you about Christianity's variations and contradictions?
I would go to church and have absolutely no idea what anybody was talking about, even though it was clearly in English. And sometimes I could understand that the service had basically meant to scare me, which I didn't really appreciate. Other times there was so much jargon, I couldn't understand it. And then we have the one church experience in Oklahoma where things change, where there's a wonderful pastor at a Mennonite church named Pastor Jeff, who delivers a sermon that I absolutely love and relate to. And it's all about how people in the church are serving the community. There's a wonderful farmer who does a little slideshow. He shows how he's been driving hundreds of miles every week to deliver hay to cattle who are starving because of these vast prairie fires that have affected Oklahoma and Kansas. And he thanks the community for having supported him in delivering the hay. It was really emotional. And it was a church where you could really see Christianity in practice. And then I really started to understand that there were Christians who took what Jesus said seriously and were trying to practice it. And I began to realize, you know, someone like Eric also was always checking his actions against what Jesus would do in a way that is, for me, highly authentic and very meaningful and frankly, very beautiful. And then throughout the trip, I started to realize I was meeting people who practice Christianity in this way.
Well, Marie, thank you so much for being with us today on the Common Wheel podcast.
And finally, Kate, why don't we hear about your interview with Amy Jo Burns?
Amy Jo Burns is a novelist, now a novelist. Her first book was a memoir. This new novel, her first, is called Shiner. And it's about a group of women in an isolated part of Appalachia who are members of a community of Christians who handle snakes. It's about their resiliency and their community, and it's also about moonshine.
Okay, that sounds good. Let's listen.
Amy Jo, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the novel is so descriptive and so detailed, and it's set in this rural, pretty impoverished region of West Virginia. What did you want to convey about that place and the people that live there, how they're influenced by the landscape or by the circumstances that they find themselves in?
I think first and foremost, I wanted to convey a sense of wonder about life in the mountains and what it really means to live a forgotten kind of life that the rest of the world doesn't understand. And I also wanted to communicate both the sacredness and the violence of choosing to live that kind of life. So I'm somebody who grew up in a faith healing church in Western Pennsylvania. And even though I don't practice my faith that particular way anymore, I really wanted to write about what it's like inside the minds and the hearts of people who do. And really, I think that means I wanted to write about what it means to be misunderstood and forgotten and ridiculed. I also think it's important to add that I never set out to write a novel that could represent an entire people group or region. I don't think any writer can really pull that off truthfully. What I hope to do is to break open a stereotype and seek out all the brutal and tender things that are hidden inside of it.
Brutal and tender, that really gets at how your description of the place renders. Like, there's a lot of hunger, there's poverty, there's illness, there's exploitation, there's mention of mining companies or the bad water that people have to drink. But there's also this incredible sense of community and this deep connection to the natural world, to the mountains and the glens and the streams that you see the characters choosing again and again, even though they might have the opportunity to go somewhere else. Shiner's main character is this teenage girl named Ren, and her father is the preacher who handles snakes and supposedly has the power to perform healings. And as you mentioned, you wanted to really treat this kind of Christian practice with humanity, but you also illustrate the dangers of that kind of religious fundamentalism, even as you give some dignity to the people that practice it. So what are you trying to convey about a faith that looks like this?
So when I was in Sunday school as a kid, we were taught this saying that went something like, you can't love the gift more than the giver, which I took to mean that it's really easy to think you want a friendship or a relationship with God, but really you just want something from God instead. I mean, of course, we wouldn't want to have a friend that only used us to get ahead in some way. And I think the scary thing is that a lot of religious people in America, like Breyer in the novel, they don't know the difference between the two. And I wonder if that's where a fault line lies between faith and religion, or maybe between faith and fundamentalism. And I think what's really dangerous about this is that there's no mutuality and there's no humility. Egos like Breyer's and Shiner go completely unchecked. And it's the people closest to someone like that who truly pay the price.
So we're just talking about Breyer, but at the same time, this is really a book about women. It's about Ren. It's about her mom, Ruby. It's about Ruby's best friend, Ivy. So what's the argument about gender that you're making in this book? Or what are you trying to show us about really female friendship in particular?
I really wanted to write a story where women take center stage and they get to be the ones with legends that are told about them. Most of the way the Bible has been interpreted comes solely from the male viewpoint, and I just find it devastatingly narrow. Before I started writing Shiner, I read this fantastic book called Salvation on Sand Mountain. It's by Dennis Covington, and it's a true account of Covington, who's a journalist, and he goes into the mountains of Alabama to cover a story of a snake-handling preacher who gets convicted for murdering his wife when she dies from a snake bite. And this book came out in the 90s, so this happened quite a while ago. But something I was left with as I finished his book was that there was this whole other story of the preacher's wife that never got told. Her longings, her dreams, her ambition, her relationship. She was only seen to the rest of the world through her husband's sin. And what a loss that is, I think, for all of us. So in part, Shiner was my way of imagining what kind of story a woman like that might tell.
Of course, Shiner, the book's title, is shorthand for people who make moonshine. And that's how we come to realize one of the book's central characters and heroes is making his living. And in fact, we learn how central that process has been. And I won't give anything away to the rest of the characters in the book, how they've all in some way relied on the process of distilling whiskey. So I'm just curious what kind of research you did to learn about the process of making moonshine in order to write this book, and maybe what surprised you about it.
So writing this book taught me so many things. I think the first and most important thing I learned was that when I'm writing something, I have to find something to delight in. And that for me with this project was moonshine. Everything about it, I fell in love with. And the interesting thing is that while I was writing this book, I was pregnant twice and nursing an infant twice.
Oh, wow.
I had to find some ways to experience what moonshine is without actually drinking it, or when I had the chance to actually taste it, it was very few and far between opportunities. But that ended up, I think, working out really well for the book, because I don't think a moonshiner's primary relationship to what he creates is taste. I think that's a huge part of it, and it's a huge part of maybe his clientele or her clientele, but it represents so much more. It represents personal history. It represents how they believe in their land and how they cultivate their land. It represents family and traditions passed down. So I was able to imagine and enter this whole lifestyle through that lens, instead of me being an outsider sitting down and saying, let me taste it and try to describe it. I was able to start by thinking, okay, why does this really matter to somebody? Why would somebody kind of dedicate their life to getting up in the middle of the night and going and do this thing that might be misunderstood? They might go to jail for it. I mean, what's really behind that? So that was a really fun and I think life-giving part of writing this book. And so when I did get to actually try moonshine, it was so much fun. I recommend anything to go somewhere to a distiller. And the great thing now is that there's a lot of people that are doing it legally. I mean, for sure, you can go to Virginia and ask a friend of a friend to get you a mason jar. So that's one way to do it.
Right.
But you can still have an amazing experience going into somebody's distillery. And most of the time, the person who made it is working there. And you can just ask them what the process is like. And then you can do a taste test. And you get a real sense of the moonshiner's relationship to this bottle that you are holding. And they'll tell you, you know, any bottle you make will be a little bit different based on the humidity that day, or, you know, the mineral makeup of the water and the corn that it grew from the farm down the street. So that's why every bottle of it will taste a little bit different. And to me, that feels so much like writing a book. You know, writers and authors and artists are so influenced by the environment that they find themselves in. And I think moonshine is no different. Moonshiners, they display such incredible faith every time they set out in the dark to make whiskey. Often a batch will get ruined at the end somehow, and a few weeks of worth is down the drain. And it takes a daily act of faith that all their efforts are going to pay off, even if they're misunderstood for what they're trying to do. There's something so faithful about that solitary practice. Because of that, I think the act of making moonshine is a spiritual practice for a lot of distillers, even if it has nothing to do with church. You know, it's simply something that comes from corn and water and sugar, and that's it. That to me is a miracle that you let that stuff sit long enough and you can get intoxicated from it.
Oh, I love that. What a beautiful place to end. And what a profound connection that I wouldn't have anticipated between making moonshine and writing and making art, showing up, looking for the small miracles and delighting in them. Well, Amy Jo Burns, thank you so much for writing such an empathetic and powerful novel and putting it out into the world. It was a pleasure to talk with you about it.
It was a pleasure for me too. Thank you so much.
The Commonweal Podcast is produced by assistant editor Griffin Olenek and the Commonweal staff in partnership with Sandberg Media. Wally Boudway composed the music and David Dalt did the editing. For the Commonweal Podcast, this is Dominic Preziosi.